Okay, well, I am going to start by talking about something else altogether, because last night, while you were all, I hope, very happily wining and dining or whatever you were doing, I was away in Manchester giving a talk to the Manchester Cycling Campaign, and it was great and that all went well, but they all wanted the meeting to finish on time. Because one of their members was involved in a TV programme that was shown on, I think, BBC One last night, I'm not sure what channel I was watching, about road rage. And it was an absolute classic example of the sort of stereotyping that we've been talking about. In fact, it was actually comical. And I just want to spend a couple of minutes just kind of reflecting on how the media, and I think particularly the broadcast media rather than the print media, does stereotyping. Because I do think that there's more of this stereotyping in the broadcast media, for reasons I'll come to, and then I'll come back to the topic of the Times. So last night's programme, it was about road raging. It contained all the stereotypes. It was wonderfully crass. It was such fun watching it in a packed pub room full of 30 cycle campaigners who were laughing at all the stereotypes. So it's kind of, but I don't know, just reflect on how you know, it's quite difficult to kind of just think outside of that room of cycle campaigners. So how is this going to go down with somebody who has no experience of cycling and doesn't spend a lot of time on city streets, because it was all about city streets. But it had the cabbie who went and decided to try out cycling. It was very staged, this programme. The cabbie goes out, tries out cycling, and he goes into a bike shop and he gets his yellow lycra and he gets his helmet and he gets a whole load of helmet propaganda from the sales chap in the shop, and he wobbles off and he's terribly wobbly and he finds the potholes a real pain and the drivers are cutting it up and that's really annoying and he gets cycle rage and then there is the cyclist who's never driven before. He's a cycling instructor, he's never driven, he gets a driving lesson and he gets a whole load of home truths from his driving instructor because he can't control his car, he's a silly cyclist, because that's a stereotype, isn't it? Then he finds that cyclists are weaving in and out of him, and it's really stressful, he's got to look everywhere, oh, bloody cyclists! At no point in the programme was there any recognition that most adult cyclists do also drive, and that some drivers do also cycle. It completely portrayed these two as totally separate tribes. In fact, it was comical in the extent to which it did that. It does reinforce the stereotype that that the cyclists are some other variety to whom you can label all these stereotypes. It was in one respect, though, it was so comical, it was less insidious than a similar programme that was broadcast by the BBC about 18 months ago called The War on Britain's Roads. And the reason why I think that was more insidious, for those of you who recall and who may well have looked at it, is that that purported to be... The point of that story, it was all helmet camera footage. And therefore, it purported to be a little snapshot of reality as recorded by ordinary people just going about their ordinary journeys. And in some respects, it wasn't... We heard the kind of shock horror kind of pre-broadcast adverts for the programme and we thought it was going to be dreadful. It was actually less dreadful than we thought it was going to be. But it ended up with some footage of some couriers having a race on London streets, charging around being absolute maniacs. And at no point did the programme makers say, this is not ordinary helmet camera footage. This was a film that was made 6 years ago by a professional filmmaker who paid the participants to take part in it. It portrayed this outrageous courier race as if that was just ordinary helmet camera footage. And that was really damaging. Bit of stereotyping last night, reflected on that as you please, but I do think that just to kind of, why is it particularly the broadcast media? And I think it's this point that it's a way of filling time. You talked about, is it the new weather? Well, it certainly is for particularly the regional and local and all these radio stations who've got to talk about something to fill up the space between the adverts, which is where they make their money from. So you can set up this cyclist versus driver kind of conflab, and I've done that interview so many times, and it doesn't matter whether I've been set up against the AA or against the RAC or against the Association of British Drivers. Every time I do that interview, I disappoint the interviewer by agreeing with the driver and the driver, the motor, the representative of the motorist, because actually we've just all got to get along. It's just, we've got to get along on road space. It's just not helpful to portray two separate tribes at war with one another. That actually makes, if you, the more you portray it as that, the more you exacerbate and legitimise behaviour that is basically, yeah, it's legit to beat up the cyclist because that's what was shown on the telly. So I do think that sort of stereotyping is unhelpful. I do think it's very useful that Edmund King, as the president of the AA, is saying that narrative is utterly unhelpful. You know, as the representative of, you know, a representative of Britain's motorists, I also cycle. We've got to get along. We've got to break down this two tribe stuff. The broadcast media do it to fill up space, and I do think that they exaggerate it. I don't think that this is a common discourse in public opinion, but it is definitely a common discourse in the broadcast media because they've got to fill up time. So that's my just reflections on last night, and then there are plenty of other things one could say about that, but I do need to get on to the Times because that's what I'm supposed to be talking about. Okay, so the Times. Let's just sort of start with a bit of context setting. What was going on politically before the Times campaign started? Well, we'd had, from 2005 through to 2010-11, we'd had this run of, this period in which Cycling England was starting to spend some money, mostly in the larger cities, in Bristol, in Exeter, in a variety of cycling towns, and although what they were getting was peanuts compared with what actually needs to be spent if we're going to catch up with Dutch levels of cycle use, it was actually making a very significant difference in the places where that money was being spent, and a detectably significant difference. You know, that has been analysed. That small amounts of money were going a very long way in terms of boosting cycle use from very low to slightly less low. But that was actually, even that small increase in cycle use was gaining us political ground. The doubling of cycle use in London has doubled the strength of the cycling vote, and that in turn has strengthened the ability of cycling campaigners to now call for more things to happen. And I think let's not underestimate the political significance of even a change from very low cycle use to slightly less low cycle use. Politically, that can make a big difference. That has been happening, as I say, in the cycling cities, and then. We had a change of government, and we had the bonfire of the quangos. Philip Hammond, the then Transport Secretary, basically decided that Cycling England was one of those quangos that was a complete waste of money. It employed only three people and no office, but it was a terrible, terrible, terrible waste of money, and therefore it had to be abolished. And really, things politically for cycling were looking about as gloomy as I've known them in, you know, I've been involved in cycle campaigning either as a volunteer or more recently as a sort of paid campaigner at CTC for, you know, most, including the voluntary time, about, help, scary, 25 years. And I think that 2011 was probably the gloomiest time for cycling's political prospects. Everything that had happened from 2005 to 2010 was going into reverse. On February the 3rd, 2012, everything changed. That's when the Times cycle campaign launched. They had been in touch with us and with Sustrans and with the London Cycling Campaign beforehand to pick our brains about what should be in their 8-point manifesto. And although we had little niggles with some of the 8 points, broadly speaking, they were pretty good. They were talking about prioritising, sorting out junctions. That's something we really stressed, that they needed to talk about junctions. They talked about 20 mph speed limits. They talked about better data on cycle use, which was an important point that we encouraged them to pick up on. They talked about private sponsorship of cycle infrastructure, which we weren't quite so impressed with. But, you know, when the Times came, you know, backing some things that we'd been talking about for a long time, we weren't going to look gift horses too hard in the mouth. Actually, I did. I was wondering at the time, what's their vested interest? Why have they done this? This was right in the middle of the Leveson inquiry when News UK was under the... News International, as it then was under the political spotlight. Or, you know, was it basically to try and distract from all that, you know, political trouble that Murdoch was in at the time? Had they seen a way to kind of just get in and... you know, at a market that the Times and the Independent, sorry, that the Guardian and the Independent had managed to do much more, giving much more coverage to the Guardian bike blog and a similar cycling column that Simon Osborne was writing in the Independent, and they just decided maybe this is a slice of readership that we also want to get in. As the campaign evolved, it became very clear that there were no subtexts. It was absolutely genuine from the individual journalists through to the editor, James Harding. They had been motivated by the fact that one of their colleagues, Mary Bowers, obviously a very popular colleague, had been left in a virtual coma. And that was, and they had just genuinely felt it on the heartstrings that they wanted to do something about this. There were no other subtexts. It was absolutely genuine, right through to the editor level. And I think this point about who are the journalists is actually really an important one, and particularly what are the interests of the editors. If James Harding had not given Kaya Burgess, a features writer up till then, who's now become the key player in the Times' cycle safety campaign, and Philip Pank, transport correspondent, but up till then, and Tim's, both of them keen cyclists, but up till then they hadn't really done much about cycling. And this gave them their head of steam with the editor's blessing. The editor kind of said, right, we're going to put a load of resources into our website, we're going to bring all our cycling stories out from behind the Times' paywall. They put a lot of resources into that campaign because the editor personally believed in it. And I think that's actually quite interesting in its own right. They had this Cities Fit for Cycling campaign. They got a few things wrong to start with. They did go into this kind of issue that we've touched on of dangerising cycling, which is this thing that's very double-edged. Does it generate political will to fix the dangers, or does it just put people off cycling and undermine the whole kind of safety in numbers effect? More cyclists is known to be associated with safer increased cycle safety. No one really knows how the causal linkage works, but it's likely to be a combination of several factors. The more cyclists there are, the more drivers get used to it, the more likely they are to be cyclists themselves, to have an understanding of what it's like to be on both sides of the windscreen. And of course it does generate increased political will to improve cycling infrastructure, which is why, as I say, there's likely a bit of kind of a reciprocal two-way effect here. If you dangerise cycling, you might be undermining that. And they did. They went off about why don't cyclists wear helmets, why do cyclists jump red lights. That's not helping. That is not helping your own campaign. They did that for one day. Actually, it was in the Sunday Times. And the Times itself sort of said, no, we've got to back off from that. We've got to kind of recognise that cycling is healthy, not dangerous. Yes, the risks are too great. That deters people from cycling. Let's fix the things that deter people from cycling. They got that narrative right after an initial wobble within the first few days. And from then on, they'd sort of particularly focused on things like the junctions. They'd had this thing about junctions in their manifesto, one of their 8 points in their manifesto. They started thinking, so how can we actually get government action on the 8 points of the manifesto? And we sort of said, well, actually, rather than trying to fix, they said the 50 most dangerous junctions. We said, how do you even quantify the 50 most dangerous junctions? Because they're not the places that with the greatest number of cyclist casualties. They might be the places that the cyclists avoid like the plague. So we said, this actually would be very, very difficult to come up with a robust way to quantify it, the most dangerous junctions. It may be that the best thing to do is to ask the cyclists to vote for it. That might be as rigorous as anything you could do. So they, at our suggestion, they created a website and invited all the 36,000 people who'd signed up as supporters of their manifesto to nominate places that needed fixing. And of course, what came out, places like the Elephant and Castle, actually, it was a pretty good way of sort of saying these are the places that most need fixing. At this stage, we were sort of, Norman Baker, as then the junior minister responsible for cycling, was beginning to get little kind of slivers of short-term funding, but we still weren't getting that long-term funding commitment, and we still haven't yet. In that sense, the Times campaign, our campaigning, has not yet succeeded in its objectives of getting sustained long-term funding for cycling. Against this background, the all-party parliamentary cycling group had seized the momentum generated by the Times campaign. They had a fantastic debate in Parliament. It was an amazing experience. It was actually in a parliamentary antechamber, Westminster Hall, not the main Commons chamber. The main Commons chamber at the time had 8 MPs in it. The antechamber had 73 MPs, and they forgot about sitting on opposite sides. They were all piled in together. They were all saying the same stuff. They all came out saying this was an extraordinary debate. It still led to only tiny bits of political action. So the MPs then had a parliamentary inquiry, which the Times came in and sponsored, the Get Britain Cycling Inquiry, and that came up with a whole load of recommendations around leadership, funding for cycling, ambitious targets, high design standards, tackling all the safety issues of lorries, driver behaviour, traffic law and enforcement, positive promotion of cycling. It said all the right things. And we're still waiting for serious political commitment to that. We got David Cameron saying, I want there to be a cycling revolution, but he voted through... The Get Britain Cycling Report had recommended there needs to be funding of at least £10 a head, sustained funding of at least £10 a head, increasing to £20 a head over time, for the whole of the UK. We actually got £10 a head for a tenth of the UK population for 2 years. So we sort of said, well, glass tenth, one-tenth full or nine-tenths empty. Well, it's nice that that David Cameron has acknowledged that £10 a head is the minimum figure. Can we now have it for the rest of the nine-tenths of the population? Now, by this stage, the Times had a change of editor. James Harding, who had backed it so personally, had moved on. The new editor wasn't as interested at a personal level. And Kaya Burgess and Philip Pank were finding it harder to get particularly the sort of features, the more in-depth coverage. They were only getting kind of news stories, average length, still having to be kind of, you know, cover both sides of the story in a more newsy way, rather than being able to kind of really push an agenda and, you know, create narratives in the way that they've been doing in earlier stages in the campaign. However, the sort of PR and corporate social responsibility side of the Times, which is independent of their news editor, has decided they want to come back in, and they're going to be doing some stuff at the party conferences this autumn, which may be a really important opportunity to kind of, you know, as we run into this sort of last year of the current government, can we stir up some competition between the political parties as to who will actually sign up to the recommendations of the Get Britain Cycling Report in their party manifestos. So, in a way, we've got one last throw of the dice with the Times backing, you know, linking up with us, us being the cycling organisations collectively, CTC, British Cycling, Sustrans, London Cycling Campaign, the local cycling campaign groups through Cycle Nation. We've all been very joined up in the way we've worked around this. I have to say, the Times has been very keen to make it their campaign, but they have kind of acknowledged that, you know, they didn't invent cycle campaigning. They have put up, you know, pages about, you know, all the other things that's been going on. Their editor, when there was a parliamentary inquiry on cycle safety, their editor appeared alongside our president, John Snow, and they were all saying the same stuff. We've actually been very joined up in the way we've presented ourselves to decision makers. And the one thing is that when the Times campaign started, that meant that the officials at the Department of Transport, who were dealing with cycle policy, suddenly, you know, from being a little backwater of the DfT, they were getting calls from Number 10. Number 10 wanted to know, what are we doing about cycling? So in that sense, having the Times really made Number 10 sit up and take notice, and it finally got David Cameron to say, yes, I want there to be a cycling revolution. He's willed the ends, he hasn't yet willed the means. We've still got one roll of the die to make that happen. But I hope that gives a kind of snapshot of just how much difference it made when a media organisation came in for very genuine personal reasons. And that, in a way, it's an exception, but I hope it gives a flavour of what the media can do, of that relationship between Tom's models were showing. When the politicians are trying to control the media and the media are trying to control the politicians, well, this was the media trying to influence the politicians on the right side, from my point of view, and it's made some impact, and we've still got a way to go.
Thanks very much, Roger. What I'm going to do is borrow my list of questions, my questions, yeah, and just ask a couple of questions by way of elucidation, then ask Ian and Rachel to come back up and we'll have a more general discussion. So, in particular, how was the Times interacting with policymakers during this? You talked of an inquiry. Clearly there were contacts with Norman Baker. Who contacted whom and in what ways?
The main thing was that from then on, whenever anything cycling, Philip Hank and Kaya Burgess were constantly on the lookout for cycling stories to keep the campaign running. Of course, we were then feeding them as many stories as we could, and when there was a story that we got half a suspicion but they needed validating, of course, they were much better able to kind of make the phone calls to sort of say, Is this true? Have you got any evidence to kind of phone up DfT's press line or other government departments? Or ultimately, to make sure that they were in on the story of David Cameron's launch. You know, they were able to push for that. So, you know, partly is they were able to influence things by researching the stories that they wanted to tell. I think that was probably the main way in which they influenced policymakers directly, simply because they were shining the spotlight on things. I don't think they were kind of, you know, dear Norman Baker, will you do X, Y, or Z? That wasn't happening. It was, you know, we set out a manifesto. Is it, you know, they've got their 8 points. We want stories as to whether any of these things are happening, and if not, why not? What's getting in the way? During the one classic moment, during that parliamentary inquiry, the Get Bread and Cycling inquiry, one of the things that came out was one of the witnesses was from the Association of Chief Police Officers, and the parliamentarians asked, so what are you doing about 20 mph speed limits? And of course, this is one of the, 20 mph was one of the things that the Times had also got on their 8-point manifesto. And the representative of ACPO said, well, we don't recommend enforcement of the 20 mph speed limits. And Julian Harper MP, who is, you know, one of the co-chairs of the All-Party Cycling Group, said, so which other laws do you not enforce? And of course, the Times, Philip Pang was just thinking, story. So, you know, at which point, ACPO immediately started backtracking, retracting, and then reviewing their policy. So it's that sort of influence. You know, it's just seizing stories and using stories to actually make, you know, make policy change happen, particularly around the 8 points of their own manifesto.
Right. But something such as the inquiry itself, that is a mechanism which takes place within the legislative framework. It has to be initiated by Parliament, I'm imagining.
No.
So how did this happen?
In that case, no, it wasn't. This wasn't, strictly speaking, a parliamentary inquiry. It was an inquiry conducted by an all-party group, and all-party groups do this all the time. They pretend to be select committees, but they're not. And most of them get ignored, most of them being sponsored by vested interests. This one was being sponsored by the Times, which actually gave it more political clout, and the government agreed to treat this as if it was a select committee in a way that it normally doesn't, which is itself interesting. But strictly speaking, it wasn't a select committee inquiry. It's not part of Parliament's formal role of scrutinising, you know, the Transport Committee scrutinising the Transport Department, and the Communities and Local Government Committee scrutinising the committees, you know, and the Treasury Select Committee, you know, it wasn't that. It was an all-party group inquiry with independent funding, in this case provided by the Times, but the government decided to treat it seriously and to respond to it as if it was a select committee. That in itself is indicative of the power of the Times.
Right. Though you had, presumably, friendly MPs who were helping on that side to make these things happen.
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, as I say, the all-party group had responded to the Times with great enthusiasm. You know, Julian Harper and Ian Austin, the two co-chairs, when as soon as the Times campaign launched, they seized a political opportunity, which is what got them starting off with an initial debate and then decided to hold a full-blown inquiry. And then, at our suggestion, we thought, well, who can provide the funding that will be needed for to make this inquiry work? We sort of said, well, let's go back to the Times, and the Times lapped it up because it gave them an opportunity for more cycling stories. Mm. So, yeah, it all came together very nicely, and that is what finally got David Cameron to say, yeah, I want there to be a cycling revolution. But it was the fact that it was the Times rather than, you know, most of these all-party group inquiries, they are funded by an economic interest. This was funded by a media organisation. That gave it more power.
What do you need funding for? What is the money spent?
A lot of work goes into, firstly, booking the rooms, or administering the, lining up and sifting the evidence, the written submissions that come in. You've read evidence to a parliamentary inquiry. We had to do all of that. We had transcribing the and then publishing the written evidence, publishing the written evidence, transcribing the oral evidence. It's actually quite a lot goes into that. And you know, it's more work than I think any of us had bargained for. We had to put in quite a lot of, we CTC and SUSTRANS actually put a lot of extra time that we hadn't bargained for into making sure that inquiry delivered a good report at the end.
Changing tactics.
Oh, and paying for, in that case, we hired Professor Phil Goodwin, leading transport academic, to act as a knowledgeable but independent reviewer of the evidence, because he's known as a, you know, top transport academic with an interest in sustainable transport, but no preconceptions around cycling. He hadn't previously done a lot of work around cycling. So we reckon that he would be seen by the Department of Transport as authoritative, but reasonably independent. He had no previous track record of you know, known views around cycling specifically. So he was actually good in that respect.
And as a media organisation, what did the Times enjoy? What was available to the Times in order to do what it did that would be difficult for CTC or another organisation that doesn't have that status?
What did they have? Well,
do the media have ways in to policymakers that are not enjoyed by the rest of us, I suppose? That's what I'm
asking. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, as I say, they if they shine a spotlight on things, then suddenly Number 10 wants to know, what are we doing about it? That was very powerful and very clear. You know, they were saying things that we've been saying for years and years and years. They were getting attention. Right. And you know, it's partly by, as I say, asking awkward questions. That is actually an important journalistic skill, and they were very good at it.
Right. But they didn't do more than run stories that got the attention of the policymakers. They weren't ringing the policymakers, I think you said, or attempting to get in by the back door.
They weren't. They were seeking to find out what the policymakers were doing. They weren't they set out their manifesto. They weren't quietly urging policymakers to do X, Y, and Z. They were writing stories about whether X, Y, and Z is happening or not. Mm. And by writing those stories, they were actually increasing the likelihood that things would get done around those stories. So by kind of, you know, as I say, one of their 8 points was, let's fix the junctions. At our suggestion, they produced a map of 10,000 junctions. They were able to write stories about how many people had voted for so many junctions to get fixed. Norman Baker was able to respond by allocating 15 million to fixing junctions. Mm. So that's how that worked. It wasn't by getting on the phone to Norman Baker and saying, will you fix some junctions? It was one of our points. They ran a story about how many people had called for junctions to be fixed.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks very much, Roger. I suggest if Ian and Rachel would like to come back up, no pressure. But I imagine that you will have interesting things to contribute to the subsequent discussion. And I'd like now to open the discussion up to everybody, responding to Roger's narrative concerning the Times, or if you wish, to the wider question of how the media interact with transport policy, up to you.